From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the trivializing of the race for the White House, political columnists Jack Drummond and Jules Whitcover collaborated on a new book that looks back on the 1988 campaign and analyzes why it was waged with soundbites, photo opportunities, and spin control. Also today, we meet writer Daniel Stern. His new collection of short stories pays homage to Ernest Hemingway, Lionel Trilling, Sigmund Freud, Henry James, and several of his other favorite writers. And we have reviews of the new funk album from George Clinton and the new movie Sex, Lies, and Videotape. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Sharon Green. Ground crews are heading for the remote mountain region of southern Ethiopia, where a U.S. weather satellite pinpointed what could be a distress signal from the missing plane of U.S. Congressman Mickey Leland. The faint transmission is coming from an area 130 miles south of the flight path Leland's aircraft was believed to be following when it vanished on Monday. Leland's press secretary, Alma Newsom, commented today on what the signal's location might mean.
But the best speculation would be if, in fact, that is his plane, that they did try to return to Addis when they could not land at the refugee camp and simply kept going farther south, hoping that they could get out of the turbulent weather that they were in.
Leland and 13 others were flying to an Ethiopian refugee camp when their plane disappeared. U.S. military personnel and aircraft have been sent to Ethiopia to help in the search, which has been repeatedly stymied by rough terrain and bad weather. Four-star Army General Colin Powell is President Bush's choice to head the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The president announced Powell's nomination during a Rose Garden ceremony this afternoon, praising the former National Security Advisor as a complete soldier. The Senate is expected to confirm the 52-year-old military man, who would replace retiring Admiral William Crowell. Powell would be the first black and the youngest chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. A National Wildlife Federation study released today lists 500 U.S. industrial plants that released the highest levels of toxic chemicals during 1987. At the top of that list is an aluminum plant in Texas. The study says the facility released more hazardous chemicals than any other industrial plant in the country. Steve Hine of member station KUHF in Houston filed this report.
The survey looked at EPA figures for 1987, and the Alcoa plant in Point Comfort, Texas, had the highest numbers, releasing 465 million pounds of toxic chemicals into the air, water, and soil around it. The plant extracts aluminum oxide from raw materials and ships it to other plants to make aluminum products, and aluminum oxide makes up the bulk of the toxic substances released. Most of the plant's toxic chemicals are buried in a licensed landfill near the plant on the Gulf Coast. So while the chemicals are being released into the environment, most are not exposed to the public. Company officials say the 1988 numbers are much lower than the 1987 figure cited in the survey. That's because the EPA has changed procedures for counting the toxins buried in the landfill. And officials hasten to add that the plant has always operated within EPA guidelines. For National Public Radio, I'm Steve Hine in Houston.
The Agriculture Department estimates this year's corn crop harvest at 7.35 billion bushels. That's 49% increase over the drought-ravaged corn crop of 1988. The new figures reflect conditions as of the 1st of August. They come a week after Congress approved an $897 billion drought relief bill for farmers. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 27 points at 2713.77. This is NPR News. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater says it's premature to expect direct talks between the U.S. and Iran about the hostage crisis in Lebanon. Said Fitzwater, we're nowhere near that. He listed several preconditions for direct dialogue with Tehran, including a clear sign from Iranian officials in authority of their willingness to enter such discussions. A published report in Tehran today said indirect U.S.-Iranian talks on the hostage issue would open within a few days, with Pakistan serving as a probable mediator. Hungary's government is offering protection from prosecution to East Germans seeking refuge at the West German embassy in Budapest. An estimated 200 East Germans are holed up there, while hundreds of others have let their Hungarian visas expire in hopes of fleeing to the West. Didra Berger reports.
For the first time today, the Hungarian government commented publicly on the East German refugee problem. At a press conference in Budapest, An Interior Minister official promised the would-be East German refugees they would not be prosecuted if they returned home voluntarily. He also said no legal action would be taken against East Germans caught the first time trying to flee across the Hungarian-Austrian border. Hungarian officials hope the assurances will convince many East Germans to return home, taking some pressure off strained Hungarian-East German relations. Meanwhile, in East Berlin, the 131 East Germans in the West German mission have shown no signs of leaving without promises of exit visas from the East German government. The East German media sharply criticized the refugees today and accused Bonn of stirring up the problem through false information. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Cologne.
The Treasury Department is preparing to raise the first $5 billion installment on the savings and loan bailout bill signed into law yesterday. One-third of $15 billion in 247-day cash management bills sold today are to be earmarked for the Resolution Trust Corporation. I'm Sharon Green, NPR News, Washington.
This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guests Jack Drummond and Jules Woodcover chronicle the changes in America's political culture. Since 1980, they've collaborated on a series of books offering postmortems of each presidential election. Their new book is called Whose Broad Stripes and Bright Stars? The Trivial Pursuit of the Presidency, 1988. It recaps an election in which campaigns were run by hired guns rather than old friends in the party and decided on the basis of image rather than issues. Drummond and Woodcover write a nationally syndicated political column. Drummond is also a frequent guest on the McLaughlin Group and the Today Show. Both reporters have covered national politics for 30 years. I asked Jules Woodcover how reporters' relationships with candidates have changed since the 1960 elections.
The basic difference is that there's a much more protection of candidates, and candidates are much more self-protective. By that I mean they're more wary about saying things off the record or on a background basis because they've been getting burned. The advent of the tape recorder and the television handheld camera has been an intrusion to a lot of candidates. It made them very, very careful about what they'll say to reporters, and that has affected the relationship in a major way.
It's also true that the candidates are more afraid now that what they say on a background basis or on a off-the-record basis, unless it is to somebody they know very well, is going to get blown into a story because there are so many reporters covering campaigns now that the competitive pressures are somewhat higher than they were. And there are always sense of people want to sort of prove their manhood or their womanhood by such stories.
Did you have more access to the candidates themselves back in 1960 than you do now?
Oh, yes. I think it's there's no question about it. One of the things that made reporting political campaigns fun in those days was that at the end of a day, the candidate would come back on the campaign bus or in the campaign plane and loosen his tie and have a few drinks with you and talk about things generally and about his own feelings about things so that you might not get something to write the next morning, usually didn't, but you got a feel for who this person was, and over a period of a campaign, you were better equipped to convey that judgment to the voters. Now, because of the attitude that exists with the presence of these devices that record voices and pictures, candidates are very, very, as I said, very wary of having that kind of open exchange.
You've gone back after several elections to write a book that chronicled how the election unfolded. So looking back not only over the elections that you've covered, but over the books that you've written, how does the 1988 campaign compare to the others? What's really unique about what happened in 1988?
Well, we've never had a campaign before, a presidential campaign in modern politics, that was sort of conducted at the level of a campaign for sewer commissioner of Buffalo. I mean, this was a particularly nasty campaign. We had a candidate, and this is new. We had one candidate, George Bush, accusing the other of a lack of patriotism, or a deficiency of patriotism. That is something we haven't had before. It was a pretty nasty campaign in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm. In talking about things that have changed over the years, one of the major things that you mentioned is the proliferation of primaries and the grouping together of primaries on, for instance, Super Tuesday. How has that changed the nature of campaigning?
Well, for one thing, is that it has spread the candidates very thin, and it adds immeasurably to the frenetic nature of a campaign. Campaigns, particularly like you mentioned Super Tuesday, became campaigns that were conducted at airports, from one airport to another, candidates flying down, making a speech, and going on to the next state. One of the rationales for Super Tuesday was that it would bring more attention to these states, candidates would spend more time, but because there were so many primaries held on that date, candidates more often than not would just make a quick hit in a state and go on, so the people in that state, in those states, really were cheated.
My guests are syndicated columnists Jack Drummond and Jules Whitcover. They've written a new book called Whose Broad Stripes and Bright Stars? The Trivial Pursuit of the Presidency, 1988. All reporters now have to go through a line of consultants and spin control doctors and so on. But you suggest that you think, in a way, reporters might be better off going through the consultants than they used to be, having access only to the to party leaders for information.
Well, I don't think we've said that in the book. Matter of fact, one of the points we made was that the domination of the so-called hired guns, the consultants, the pollsters, the various media experts, has taken the campaign to a large degree out of the hands of candidates. In the Bush campaign particularly, those people dictated the strategy, and George Bush was a very pliant performer for them.
No, but you're right about that. There is a point. We did make a point in the book that you're getting at, which is a little different. And that is that the value of consultants, or the sort of the symbiotic relationship between consultants and reporters, gets you a better picture of the campaign, in the sense that the consultant knows that he's going to be dealing with the same reporters 2 years down the road, 4 years down the road, six, eight, every even numbered year ad infinitum. And this puts some burden on the consultant to be reasonably credible in dealing with the press. And the fact is that the press, that for that reason, often gets a better picture of a campaign than when they were dealing with, and I think this was the point we made, than when they were dealing with county chairman and state chairman who were going to talk to you once and you were never going to see them again. And if they wanted to lie to you, that was there was no price to pay for them.
What do you think that the campaign has gone into the hands of consultants and spin control doctors? You watch a campaign now and you feel like you're not hearing the candidates speak, you're hearing their scriptwriters speak, and you're hearing the scriptwriters' one-liners. And even if that's always been the case to some degree, it certainly seems to be more so than ever now.
Well, part of it clearly is the sort of geometric progression and the increase in the influence of television, and particularly the evening news broadcasts on the networks every night, you know, 6:30 or 7 o'clock. And the voters have become, you know, as they have in everything else, they've become sort of spectators rather than participants. The day of big rallies is very rare these days. And they take their news and their picture of politics off these broadcasts. And the premium there, obviously, is in getting a visually attractive event that can make one point quickly and vividly.
George Bush ran a very negative campaign in 1988. What was the rationale for that in among his aides?
That it worked. They started out, they had a candidate in Bush who had, this is going back in the spring of 1988, they had a candidate who, although he was winning the Republican nomination, had very high negatives in the polls. A lot of people had a lot of doubts about him. A lot of people didn't like him. A lot of reservations about his ability and the force of his personality and whether he had any sort of there. The Bush people came upon through some polling data, focus group so-called, they came upon some obvious weaknesses in Dukakis. They set about to exploit those weaknesses in Dukakis as a way to change the focus of the campaign, hoping this would drive up Dukakis' negatives, which in fact it did, and that it would drive down Bush's negatives, which in fact it did. And what happened was it worked so much better than they expected, and Dukakis let them get away with it for so long, they just continued it all through the campaign. They never had to change.
Why did Dukakis let them get away with it?
Well, I think a lot of it goes to the kind of man he is. Dukakis did not favor the demeaning of a campaign. He had a kind of an academic approach toward the presidential campaign. He thought certain issues were worthy of being discussed at the presidential campaign level and others not. He also thought that some of these other issues that were brought against him not only were not worthy to be in a presidential campaign, but would not be effective. He made a very, very serious mistake there. He could not bring himself to believe, for instance, that the fact that he had vetoed a bill in Massachusetts that would have required the teachers to lead the students in the Pledge of Allegiance would be an issue that could be damaging to him. By the same token, the information that the Republicans got about his prison furlough program, the so-called Willie Horton case, he didn't believe that that was presidential either and that that could hurt him. And he learned the hard way that it could.
Did you talk to any of Dukakis's consultants and ask them what they would have done differently?
Well, we talked to all of them, and at the time, too, not just after the campaign, during the campaign and after. And many of them, I mean, there was no question that there were some people in that campaign who were urging Dukakis to do it differently. Dukakis, though, has his own mind about what he's going to do on some of these things. He's willing to take consultants' advice and direction only up to a point. And as Jules just said, he became convinced these issues were trivial and were not presidential, and he was just stubborn about it.
So what do you think presidential candidates in 1992 will take away from the successful negative campaign of 1988?
Well, I think they'll take away the basic lesson, as Jack indicated earlier, that it works. We saw it before at 1988 in local elections. We're seeing it again after 1988, where more and more candidates are going to negative campaigning on the advice of professional handlers. There was a time that it was kind of axiomatic in politics that you did not attack your opponent, you did not go negative, until you had established yourself firmly as a positive candidate, that you gave the voters reasons to vote for you and have a positive attitude about you. That's gone by the boards now. Now candidates come out of the gate attacking the other guy, and they will probably continue to do that as long as there are indications, strong indications that it works. If there should be some backlash, as there have been in a couple of elections, perhaps we'll see a cleaner election next time, but I wouldn't bet the farm on it.
Let's take a short break and we'll talk some more. My guests are Jack Drummond and Jules Woodcover. They write a daily syndicated newspaper column on national politics, and they've covered presidential campaigns for over 30 years. Their new book is called Whose Broad Stripes and Bright Stars, The Trivial Pursuit of the Presidency, 1988. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Jack Drummond and Jules Woodcover are my guests. You quote something that Bush's media advisor, Roger Ailes, said in terms of the response that they were getting from the media. He said, "We felt that we were doing reasonably well in the evening news, but we thought it was because we were giving the networks what they wanted. They either want mistakes, pictures, or attacks, and we were giving them pretty good pictures and pretty good lead stories, and we were sticking to our theme of the day, whatever that was. We were disciplined, giving them the sound bites and the feed that they wanted. It wasn't that they were rolling over for us. It was that we were basically programming something that they would air, and therefore we were basically doing our job at that time." There's something very scary about that quote, you know, that they thought of themselves as programming the evening news.
Well, that's exactly right. If you had to give a trophy for the most valuable player of the 1988 political season, it probably would have gone to Roger Ailes. In fact, we think the networks did roll over for the Bush campaign. One of the things we did in writing this book was we took the three commercial networks' evening news broadcasts for every night from the day after the Republican convention through the first debate in Winston-Salem, which was about 35 days, and went through and examined very carefully what they did, what they decided was news on those 35 nights. And it was very clear that the Bush campaign controlled the agenda. They were always on the offensive. They were always providing an interesting visual, an interesting picture, which is what television loves. And Dukakis, except on one or two occasions, was usually a fellow standing in front of a blue curtain at a podium defending himself against the previous day's charges. It was a disaster for him. And it may have been what decided the whole thing right there.
Look, let's look at some of the behind-the-scenes information that you chronicle in your new book. Let's look at the debates. A question that really kind of knocked out Dukakis was a question that was posed by Bernard Shaw, that if Kitty Dukakis was raped and murdered, would Dukakis favor an irrevocable death penalty? Now, he was really criticized for coming off like really cold in his answer to this, for not at all recognizing the emotional subject matter of it, and then for going astray into all these other subjects. You say he was actually prepared for a question like that, and he had a prepared answer, which he didn't use.
Yes, well, he was not prepared for that specific question. Nobody dreamed that he would be asked a question so specific about his wife. But he was prepared for a question about his attitude toward crime, because Bush had been accusing him of being soft on crime. And the answer that he was going to give went something like this. My father was attacked and mugged in his office. I have a brother who was killed by a hit-and-run driver who we believe was under the influence of alcohol and drugs. I've experienced violence and crime in my own life, and I don't need any lessons from George Bush or anybody else about how to be tough on crime. But he didn't give the answer, and that was one of the most baffling things about the Dukakis performance.
Why didn't he give that answer? Did you find out?
No, that's the mystery. Nobody knows. He doesn't know himself. He can't. It's impossible to explain. He just didn't. It didn't come. He didn't connect it with the question. I guess he was startled, but. You know what the point about, I mean, the killing thing about that question is, there are these things that happen in campaigns that Lee Atwater, the Republican chairman who was Bush's campaign manager, likes to call defining moments in campaigns. And defining moments are those that are particular exchanges or moments on television that crystallize questions or doubts about candidates or resolve them sometimes. But that are moments that are, you know, rebroadcast and that make people's opinions come together. And that bloodless response that Dukakis gave to that question sort of crystallized all the reservations about whether he had a human side, which in fact he does have, and was a killer.
My guests are Jack Drummond and Jules Woodcover. I'd like to ask you a few questions about your own approach to reporting. You've been a team together for how many years now?
12 years. 12 long years.
How did you start working together?
Well, we were competitors for many years covering politics. And in 1977, Jules was working for the Washington Post, and I was working for the Washington Star. And we had talked about doing this kind of column for some years. And he was getting so close to doddering retirement age, I thought we better get started. So we came together in 1977, and at the Star is where we started. And been doing it ever since.
What's your technique for working together on a story, both in terms of the reporting and the writing?
Well, I usually do all the reporting and all the writing, and then the Jack delivers the column to the syndicate. Seriously, we have a very good working relationship. We don't keep score. We write five newspaper columns and a magazine column every week. That's six columns a week. It's a lot of work. We discuss the material we're going to work on. One person usually reports and writes the column, and the other will assist him with information that he gets that will add to the column. And very occasionally, we may actually sit down and collaborate on a column. But I think what really has made it go for this long is that each of us wants to do a little more than the other. So we don't have any feeling that anybody is slacking. We don't keep score. We've written six columns a week for 12 years. I have no idea how many of them Jack has written, how many I have written. And we don't have particular days. When a column is ready to go, it goes. Sometimes Jack will write four columns in a row, and sometimes I will.
Can people tell your writing style apart?
Yeah, if it's If it's in English, I usually have written it. No, the fact is there are differences. The columns that have a lot of sentences that begin and but, those are ones I've written. Columns that have sentences begin also, comma, Jules has written. That's one way you can tell us apart.
Jules Woodcover. Now, Jack Drummond is on the McLaughlin Group every week.
That's his responsibility. Don't ask me to explain it.
Well, I want you to explain how come he's doing so much TV and you're not.
Well, because he's the tall, dark, and handsome one.
Is that all you're going to say about it?
It's because I have an infinite tolerance for nonsense.
Well, let me ask you, if you ever get frustrated on the McLaughlin Group, it's one of those shows where everybody disagrees, and you know what they're going to disagree on as soon as the topic's brought up. It's a real kind of free-for-all brawl that might be actually very well rehearsed beforehand. I don't know, but is it ever a frustrating experience for you?
No, it's not rehearsed at all. And it's not frustrating to me because it is not something that I take seriously. I mean, it is. You show up and you do 30 minutes of arguing back and forth, but it is not serious journalism, and no one is more aware of that than I am.
Then why do you do it?
For the money.
Uh-huh.
That's the best reason.
Well, that's interesting. One last question for you both. What is the function for you of publishing after each election a detailed chronicle of what took place in that presidential campaign?
Well, on the most practical level, it keeps our names and work before the political community, people that we have to go to work to do our column every day. It opens doors for us in places around the country where perhaps our column doesn't appear. But also, I think beyond that, it's very helpful to go back after the campaign and sort it out. It all happens. I know the public thinks it lasts forever, but for us it goes pretty quickly, day after day, and we don't have a lot of time to reflect. Well, I found it very helpful, and I think Jack has too, to after the campaign to sit down, sift it all through, and make some judgments about what really it all means that we haven't been able to do because of the rush of events.
There is one other. It is a when you finish. Jules had written several books before we became partners, and I don't think I ever would have done a book if we hadn't become partners. We've done three now like this together, and I find them as noxious as they are to work on sometimes. I find it worthwhile because when you finish the book, the research for the book, you think you know more about that campaign than any other reporter in the world because you have gone back over all this ground. We did 80-some interviews for this book after the fact. Our last book, I think we did over 100 interviews after the fact. And that helps you write a better column for the next 4 years because you can say with the authority of really knowing it that X and Y or so or such and such happened, not all of which was that clear at the end of the campaign.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you. We enjoyed it.
Thank you.
My guests have been Jack Drummond and Jules Woodcover, syndicated columnists who've just collaborated on the new book, Whose Broad Stripes and Bright Stars, The Trivial Pursuit of the Presidency, 1988. It's published by Warner Books. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with writer John McPhee. He's been a staff writer for The New Yorker for over 25 years. His new book, The Control of Nature, looks into three cases of people living at the brink of natural disaster. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Instead of attending his high school graduation, Daniel Stern went on the road with Charlie Parker, but Stern soon gave up the musician's life for the literary life. Coming up, Daniel Stern talks about his new collection of short stories, inspired by the works of his favorite writers, including Ernest Hemingway and Henry James. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews George Clinton's new album. Ken says Clinton is second only to James Brown in the influence he's had on black music. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Sex, Lies, and Videotape. It's only the first feature film from writer and director Steven Soderbergh, but it earned him top honors at this year's Cannes Film Festival. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Sharon Green. President Bush has nominated Army General Colin Powell to become chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The president praised Powell's distinguished military career and described the former National Security Advisor as the complete soldier. The president chose Powell over several more senior officers. If confirmed by the Senate as expected, the 52-year-old Powell will be the youngest chairman of the Joint Chiefs and the first black to hold the highest military post in the nation. A weather satellite has detected a faint emergency signal from an aircraft in Ethiopia. The signal appears to be coming from a place outside the area being searched for a plane that disappeared 3 days ago with Texas Congressman Mickey Leland and 13 others on board. The U.S. is sending personnel and equipment to Ethiopia to join the search. Details of that effort were released at the White House today, as Michael Richards reports.
The White House says a sizable contingent of U.S. military personnel are already on the ground in Ethiopia. There are 88 people there so far, with another 78 on the way. The Air Force says a U-2 spy plane has already made a pass over the search area, and the film from that flight is on its way to Europe to be developed. It'll take about 24 hours to get the pictures back. A medical team, evacuation helicopters, and a transport plane have already landed. Another plane with spare parts and technical equipment is en route. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said the president has asked for regular reports on how the search for Leland is going. For National Public Radio, this is Michael Richards at the White House.
Lebanon has experienced its most violent day since the latest round of civil war battles erupted in March. At least 20 people were killed and 130 wounded in shattering artillery duels between Christian army units and Syrian gunners. Details from Mike Theodulu.
For weeks, the Lebanese have been waiting for what they call the final battle. Many believe that began today. Ambulances screamed through the streets, their sirens blaring as thunderous explosions shook Beirut. Civilians used to months of nighttime shelling were caught by surprise in the streets. Many abandoned their cars in panic. Radio stations interrupted programs, warning people to race for shelter, and they broadcast appeals for blood. Several forest fires burned out of control on the wooded slopes of the Christian enclave. The shelling duel started shortly before noon when Syrian gunners slammed hundreds of high-caliber shells into the already devastated presidential palace of the Christian leader, General Aoun. His gunners lost no time replying. They blasted residential areas in West Beirut and the Hezbollah-dominated southern suburbs, and they targeted Syrian supply lines in the Bekaa Valley, 7 miles from the Syrian border. For National Public Radio, I'm Mike Theodulu in Nicosia.
White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater today held open the possibility of U.S.-Iranian talks on the hostage crisis, but he called it premature to expect direct talks anytime soon. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed above the 2,700 level for the first time in nearly 2 years. The Dow gained 26 points, closing at 2,712.63. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Platform shoes that would give the average person vertigo, wildly colored hair, stage sets that create underwater habitats, and entrances from flying saucers. These are just a few of the things that distinguish the performances of funk master George Clinton. Clinton has just released a new album, his first in over 5 years. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of The Cinderella Theory.
Enthusiastically, desperately, and eagerly, I searched for you.
Now in his third decade of music making, George Clinton is second only to James Brown in the influence he's exerted on black popular music. The fact that he's not nearly as well known as James Brown only makes his innovative art more intriguing and more poignant.
Clinton took James Brown's layered, percussive soul style of the 60s and made it his own in the 70s. Adding elements of acid rock, Sly and the Family Stone, and science fiction, Clinton became a kind of guru of funk. He presided over a large, constantly shifting number of musicians that operated like a commune, and in the midst of all this, Clinton wrote and produced and made oracular pronouncements about the state of the world, all without ever losing a sense of humor about himself. At the same time, Clinton kept a curiously low profile. He appeared on stage most often in disguise and never dominated the proceedings. Even on this new album, he frequently lets the backup singers vocalize on the leads with him. That's She Got It Going On. Clinton used to tell interviewers that his ultimate aspiration was to become, quote, the Black Beatles. At the time he was saying this in the mid-70s, it did look as if he had a shot at something like that. He was scoring hits with the two primary outlets for his music, the bands Parliament and Funkadelic, and he was achieving commercial success with unprecedented playfulness and savvy. Sometimes not even his fans realized that Parliament and Funkadelic were actually the same band, signed to different record companies to maximize the product, the profits, and the fun. Although he's never become a superstar, Clinton's influence on the current generation of pop musicians is becoming more apparent. The hip hip-hop group De La Soul borrowed a snippet from Funkadelic's decade-old song Not Just Knee Deep for its own hit, Me, Myself, and I, and the rap group Public Enemy pays homage to Clinton while performing on One Cut on the Cinderella Theory.
Attention already, the station jocks. I got to be serious, slamming on my box. So what I try my best to do is keep the decibels up so high my neighbors call the cops. Now when the bang gets the tweaking, you know the groove is peaking. I mean harder than a cinder block. Okay, I know you know what I mean. I keep my body tweaking on my record machine. Now do me a favor, don't let so many commercials disrupt the playlist. The E-Diddy-Yock is what makes me say this. About groove control, well there's no such thing. When I turn on my box, I'm ready to swing. So I can go down, down, get down with it. I be going down, but you gotta be down to get it. Yeah, we tweaking on my radio. Serious slamming on my box, get off my jock.
Too often on this album, Clinton is doing something he's never done before. He's following, not leading. That is to say, instead of coming up with songs and riffs and turns of phrase that deepen and expand his funk vocabulary, Clinton is doing variations on music made by the younger generation. I fear that there's no song on this album that will decisively reestablish Clinton's primacy in pop music. There's no Atomic Dog here, no One Nation Under a Groove. No groove, in fact, around which a new George Clinton audience might organize itself. The closest Clinton comes to a new monster riff is the album's first single, Why Should I Dog You Out?
George Clinton is currently touring with the latest version of Parliament Funkadelic, a group he's calling the P-Funk All-Stars, and you should do everything you can to see him when he comes to your town. Trust me, at age 48, Clinton will be doing a better, wilder, and more creative show than the Rolling Stones or The Who or anyone else out there on the road this summer. And pretty soon, most of Clinton's Parliament Funkadelic records are going to be released on compact disc, a project that's long overdue. There's so much of this stuff that you might need a little consumer advice. Here it is. Buy all of it.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. This is Fresh Air. The stories we love inform how we live and sometimes change our lives. That's why the short stories in Daniel Stern's new collection, Twice Told Tales, take their inspiration and titles from writers and thinkers Stern loves. There's The Liberal Inspiration by Lionel Trilling, a story. A Clean, Well-Lighted Place by Ernest Hemingway, a story. And others that pay homage to E.M. Forster, Henry James, and Sigmund Freud. Stern says that he's always found time to write, but hasn't always made his living as a writer. He's been a cellist for the Indianapolis Symphony, an advertising and marketing executive for CBS and Warner Films, and now he directs the humanities programs at the 92nd Street Y in New York. The stories in Twice Told Tales revolve around different ways of leading a literary life. I asked Daniel Stern if when he was young and starting to write, he yearned to live the literary life.
Oh, it was an absolute dream. Of course, I was a musician at first. I was a cellist, and I went on the road with Charlie Parker instead of going to college. In fact, instead of going to my high school graduation, I went on the road with Parker. But I was already scribbling a bit, and then when I was off in the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra, sort of exiled in Indianapolis, I was reading the Partisan Review and eagerly desperate to plunge into the literary life one way or another.
Let me back up and get back to Charlie Parker. What exactly were you doing with him on the road?
Oh, there was one of those, they did an arrangement called Charlie Parker and Strings, and they did a pickup group, and a friend said, hey, you want to play this gig and get to go on the road? You come back and you play the Apollo and Birdland. And I did it.
Were you on any of the With Strings recording sessions?
I'm on the underground one. There were two of them. One was the recording of the actual performance we played, and the other is I was not in the studio one, no. That was my teacher, actually, Frank Miller, who was on that.
Mm-hmm. So here you were in the music world, and you really wanted to get into the literary world. What did the literary world mean to you, in besides sitting at home and writing?
I guess it meant a way to live saying what you want to say in fictional terms. It seems to me I always wanted to interpret the world around me, and the literary life was secondary. The actual literary activity was primary. And I've always been terribly social and also terribly eager to be alone in a room with a pencil and a paper or now a computer. So it just meant a chance to live in my imagination.
There's a paragraph I'd like you to read from your story, The Liberal Imagination. And this is a story about poetry readings in the 1950s. I mean, this is a paragraph about poetry readings in the 1950s.
Ah, okay. In the late 50s, I helped Gregory Corso organize the first coffee shop readings in New York. That was when he was still a tough street kid, fresh from his first readings at the City Lights bookstore. And an editor at Dutton asked me to pitch in on poetry. Poetry was going to be important. Years went by as in a dream. Poetry went back to being poetry again, i.e. peripheral. Publication parties became more elaborate. The network of referral editors I needed to keep a flow of work often resulted in a grateful invitation. It offered a social life of sorts. Ah, the secrets hidden there. Who trashed whose book in the Times for what not-so-secret motive of revenge or envy? How much editorial rewriting actually was done on whose Pulitzer Prize nonfiction book? Who was secretly homosexual when people were still furtive on that score, but enjoyed attacking openly homosexual authors? It was all a whirling cesspool, or it was simply the world, depending on how detached or how involved you were. I chose to think it was the world.
Did you choose to think it was the world?
Yes, I kind of think that's the way of the world. I mean, although I think there's a substratum of integrity in all this. It's just a sense of the world as marketplace, and literature too has its life as marketplace. As I say in the paragraph, poetry began to be important at the time of the poetry readings. Now it's the province of professors in universities. Although I shouldn't say entirely, because I'm director of humanities at the 92nd Street Y, and we have the Poetry Center there, which has magnificent attention to poetry. But it's a rather special case.
Yeah, well, the series that takes place at the 92nd Street Y is really one of the best series of readings by authors probably in the country.
It has been since 1938, I guess, when T.S. Eliot read there.
Mm-hmm. You've not only written many novels, but you've also functioned as an advertising and marketing executive for movies and for television. And I was wondering how you got into that. It seems really far removed from the novels that you write.
Well, the joke used to be that someone asked me, why did you stop being a musician? I said, well, I gave up the financial insecurity of being a musician for the financial security of being a serious novelist. And that kind of tells one part of the story. Then I gradually edged my way because if you can handle words, you can write advertising copy. And I began to write advertising copy in order to pay the bills, in order to sort of join society, get married, be a mensch, you know. And somehow I never believe, and still don't believe, people who tell me that they are so drained by the day at the office that they can't write when they get home at night. I think if you've got a book to write, you'll write it. And I think writing advertising copy or any other kind of business writing taps your soul about as much as writing a letter to the laundry about some shirts they've lost. I mean, it can be fun to do and it's a good craft, but it doesn't drain you, it doesn't tap your soul. Now, actually, my career got a little out of hand. I was just supposed to write copy and then go home at night and do my books. But I got a little too good at it, I guess, and then they promoted me. I guess it's the Peter Principle. Then I got to be in management, and I found myself riding through the gates of Warner Brothers in a limousine. And my wife said to me, how did this happen? And that wasn't the original idea.
What kind of stuff were you writing during your official working hours?
In the beginning, I was an advertising copywriter. Everything from Coca-Cola to Westinghouse to Buick to the usual stuff.
Some people would have a crisis of conscience that the same words that they're using to write their novels are the words that they're using to sell products that they don't necessarily believe in. That ever bother you?
Nope, because as a matter of fact, I try to deal with that in The Rose Rabbi. The hero of The Rose Rabbi, which is a comic novel, is someone whose job is he's an ethical advisor to an advertising agency. He sits in a small room with books with the Talmud and the ethics of Spinoza and advises them as to whether they can do this with that product and so forth. It was my attempt to deal comically with the dilemma, but the dilemma, I suppose, exists. I was never asked to do anything venal or anything I didn't believe in. It doesn't seem to me much to matter whether someone drinks Coke or Pepsi, and if I tell them to drink Coke, it's fine. They can make up their own mind. It's never occurred to me I had abnormal power. And I don't believe they're the same words you use, by the way. Contrary to what either moralists or the new deconstructionists will tell you, the deconstructionists from Saussure on will tell you that the basic structures of Jane Austen are the same structures as are in an ad or a matchbook cover. Well, I kind of don't believe that.
Have you ever written copy for your own book jackets or for your own press releases for your books?
I confess, absolutely. The book you have in your hand, I did a lot of the copy on the jacket.
Well, let me read some of it.
Oh, my God. Take it back. I lied.
Is this going to be horrible for you?
No, go on. Okay. My editor won't forgive me, but go on. It's all right.
Okay. This may be the most unusual love story in contemporary fiction, the love affair between an American writer and five great writers of the past. For some time now, these stories have been appearing in magazines, startling and entertaining readers with their fresh approach to the short story form.
Sounds right to me.
Is it good to write it yourself instead of leaving it in other people's hands? No, it could be very frustrating to have somebody else trying to describe your work and not getting it right.
Not really. Normally, I like to have them as someone else do it. However, this concept was so personal. And frankly, I mean, I'm not boosting this as a great big deal original thing, but no one has done exactly what I've done in this book. I was certainly involved in writing it, and I had the chutzpah to call it The Most Unusual Love Affair, et cetera, you know.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of restaurants and bars that appear in your stories. And there's business transactions that take place there, meeting people. Did you ever go to public places like that to write?
I spent approximately, 12 of my... I married rather late. I was a single semi-bohemian for about 12 years. And I hung around, but I was a bohemian in a kind of a dreadfully upscale style. I don't know where I had the nerve. I was a bohemian on the arm. In other words, instead of living like a real bohemian down in the village and really keeping a tight rein on your finances, I just lived it big. And I got to live in I hung out in the Oak Room at the Plaza, and I hung out at the Russian Tea Room. Russian Tea Room became kind of my home. In fact, the last story in the book is called, there's a restaurant called the Russian Rendezvous, which is rather transparently my great beloved hangout, the Russian Tea Room. In fact, A Clean, Well-Lighted Place by Ernest Hemingway tackles that sort of directly.
Mm-hmm.
In a way, that's that sense of what it's like to be alone or with a friend in a bar and writing.
Well, I know I don't go to public places to write or to read now, though. Sometimes I'm stuck in them and have to work there. But when I was a student in college, I would intentionally go to, like, the student union or to the Rathskeller or something to work there, because it would keep me awake, and the hum of everybody would create the kind of white noise that would help me focus on what I was doing.
There's something funny about it. I can't figure it out. I still do it. There's a little place called Ireland on Madison Avenue, and when I leave the Y, I go over there and I have a Bellini, which takes me back to Harry's Bar in Venice, where I used to have Bellinis, and I work on a short story before I go home, which is 4 or 5 blocks away only.
Daniel Stern, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Daniel Stern's collection of short stories, Twice Told Tales, is published by Paris Review Editions. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is joining us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, I hear you're going to be whaling this evening.
That's right. Noah will be. He was up in Prince William Sound with people who aren't, they're not really whaling, but they are researching killer whales. And, of course, they're curious to know how the Exxon Valdez oil spill might have affected the whales. They will be hearing that. We'll also be hearing news of General Colin Powell, who has been tapped by President Bush to be chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He'll be one of the youngest and certainly the first black to ever hold that highest uniformed position in the military. And news about a controversial remark by Pope John Paul II about the Jews.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. It was written in 8 days, filmed in just over 5 weeks, on a budget of a little more than $1 million, and has already won international acclaim. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review of Sex, Lies, and Videotape.
The director, Steven Soderbergh, is the youngest ever to win the grand prize at the Cannes Film Festival. And even more galling, the movie is his first feature. All that, taken together with the rest of the hype and ballyhoo surrounding Sex, Lies, and Videotape, makes it a very easy film to dislike. Easy, that is, until the lights go down. The first thing you notice is that this movie is fun. It's witty and sexy and intriguing, and the characters wrap you around their little fingers. There are only 4 of them. Andie MacDowell plays a southern housewife and former high school beauty who now finds herself strangely uninterested in sex, especially with her dashing but self-enamored husband, a hotshot lawyer played by Peter Gallagher. But McDowell's sister, played by Laura San Giacomo, is carrying on a tempestuous affair with McDowell's husband. She doesn't like him any better than McDowell does, but she'll do anything to get back at the sibling she's always despised. Into the heart of this pulsing triangle drifts the husband's old college buddy, played by James Spader, a gentle, oddly insinuating young man who has a way of drawing women into conversation and getting very intimate very quickly. Here he is bearing his soul to Andy McDowell and getting her to bear hers.
I think the sex is overrated. I think that people place far too much importance on it. And I think that stuff about women want it just as bad as men is crap. I mean, I think that women want it, I just don't think that they want it for the same reason that men think they do. Do you understand what I'm...
Yeah, I remember reading somewhere that men learn to love the person that they're attracted to, and that women become more and more attracted to the person that they love.
God, that's really beautiful. I like that.
I'm just quoting.
So are you going to tell me something personal?
Do you want me to?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I don't want it to be something gross about some scar or something. I want it to be something really personal about yourself. You know,
all right, okay. I'm impotent.
Not that Spader doesn't like women. He just doesn't like them live. His sex life consists of videotaping women as they recount their sex lives to him. Then, alone at last, he takes off his clothes and watches their confessions. In a way, his approach to sex is exactly the opposite of Gallagher and San Giacomo's. To them, as to adulterers from time immemorial, sneaking around and lying is a turn-on. To Spader, and finally to the women whom he tapes, the sexiest thing you can do is tell the truth. In fact, part of what draws McDowell and San Giacomo to Spader is the sense that, although he's scrupulously honest, there's a layer of truth he hasn't unburied in himself. And the attempt to get to the bottom of him is, for them, the ultimate turn-on. Unfortunately, the Spader character has no bottom. Or rather, when we get to it during the film's climactic videotape, it feels tidy, contrived, and psychologically false. For the movie's first two-thirds, Steven Soderbergh has captured the surfaces of these lives perfectly. It's when he dives beneath those surfaces that we realize we're watching the work of a man who is, after all, only 26 years old. Still, he's directed his actors like a master, especially the women. San Giacomo, who seems to be inventing her own gritty eroticism before our eyes, and McDowell, who shows us in subtle ways that her character's repression is the flip side of a spurned sensuality. Sex lies in videotape isn't completely satisfying, but you may find yourself walking out of it feeling exhilarated. Soderbergh makes it seem as though the world were full of miraculous, undiscovered women, each in her own way a new universe.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet John McPhee, one of this country's most respected writers. His latest book examines man's attempts to alter nature. Also, screenwriter Lowell Ganz tells us about the true-life calamities behind the new film Parenthood. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.